defects of the fine interview we had on the 15th of September, just a month ago, wasn't it? And today is October 16th, and we're in the apartment of Newman and Smith here in Medford Leeds.
By courtesy of the Tolls, who have so detoured to do this. And we appreciate their many interests in the meeting, this one being relatively new to me. Came to the meeting from Medford, Massachusetts, and when we were first there we had no car, and I'm afraid that our attendance was pretty sporadic. It was a dogleg trip to get from by public transportation from Medford to Cambridge meeting. When we managed to get a car, we came quite regularly, and before too long we were usually accompanied by Hinosti.
Oh, yes.
And her family. That made a pretty full car, but it worked out very well. I didn't bring my membership, and I guess Marion didn't bring her membership until I was asked by Lydia Cadbury to help with arrangements for some study groups or symposium, whatever we call them. One of them was the man on leave from Constantinople.
Bob Avery?
Who?
Bob Avery?
Yes, Bob Avery. And he, it seems to me that he was a leader of the group, and I was made the physical arrangements for the group to meet. I guess it was off of the campus at the time, not in the meeting, but else near in the neighborhood somewhere. And we continued with a slightly varied form after meeting on some other occasions. Marion and I had kept our membership at Buffalo because that was a small meeting, only recently organized or reorganized as a monthly meeting, and we did keep our membership there for a while until we became, she I guess with the first day school and I with this committee, which first helped for Avery and then for other meetings. The kids came to Sunday school. Seems to me that Marion taught in the Sunday school, and after a while she was on the Sunday school committee. Later on she was the Sunday school coordinator, or whatever title they used for it, for what, 3 years maybe, or four, I don't know how many. There was a modest payment made for the services of the Sunday school coordinator, and that coupled with her earlier part-time employment was just exactly enough to qualify her for Social Security benefits.
I'm glad to know that,
We have marveled many times at the amount of pay which came to her as a consequence of that minimum number of quarters. You don't understand the Social Security system very well, but it certainly was overly generous. She was also on the Center Furnishings Committee for a long time. And she enjoyed the work, and she also enjoyed the personal association with two members of that committee particularly. One is Nicholson, who is still on the committee, still the chair, I guess. And the other one was the wife of the violinist.
Marta Silberman?
The other one was Marta Silberman, and we used to get Christmas cards from them. Marion, and those two
defects of the fine interview we had on the 15th of September, just a month ago, wasn't it? And today is October 16th, and we're in the apartment of Newman Smith here in Medford Leeds.
By courtesy of the Tolls, who have so detoured to do this. And we appreciate their many interests in the meeting, this one being relatively new to me. Came to the meeting from Medford, Massachusetts. And when we were first there, we had no car, and I'm afraid that our attendance was pretty sporadic. It was a dogleg trip to get by public transportation from Medford to Cambridge meeting. When we managed to get a car, we came quite regularly. And before too long, we were usually accompanied by Henoste.
Oh, yes.
And her family. That made a pretty full car, but it worked out very well. I didn't bring my membership, and I guess Marion didn't bring her membership until I was asked by Lydia Cadbury to help with arrangements for some study groups or symposium, whatever we call them. One of them was the man on leave from Constantinople.
Bob Avery?
Who?
Bob Avery?
Yes, Bob Avery. And he, it seems to me that he was a leader of the group, and I was made the physical arrangements for the group to meet. I guess it was off of the campus at the time, not in the meeting, but else near in the neighborhood somewhere. And we continued with a slightly varied form after meeting on some other occasions. Marion and I had kept our membership at Buffalo because that was a small meeting, only recently organized or reorganized as a monthly meeting, and we did keep our membership there for a while until we became, she, I guess, with the first day school, and I with this committee, which first helped for Avery and then for other meetings. The kids came to Sunday school. Seems to me that Marion taught in the Sunday school. After a while, she was on the Sunday school committee. Later on, she was the Sunday school coordinator, or whatever title they used for it, for what, 3 years maybe, or four, I don't know how many. There was a modest payment made for the services of the Sunday school coordinator, and that, coupled with her earlier part-time employment, was just exactly enough to qualify her for Social Security benefits.
I'm glad to know that.
We have marveled many times at the amount of pay which came to her as a consequence of that minimum number of quarters. You don't understand the Social Security system very well, but it certainly was overly generous. She was also on the Center Furnishings Committee for a long time. And she enjoyed the work, and she also enjoyed the personal association with two members of that committee particularly. One is Nicholson, who is still on the committee, still the chair, I guess. And the other one was the wife of the violinist.
Marta Silberman?
The other one was Marta Silberman, and we used to get Christmas cards from them. Marion and those two women seemed to have things in common to an extent beyond the contacts of Marion with some others, although she was outgoing and agreeable to everyone. In the morning, Sunday morning meetings, I remember with pleasure the fact that we did have a fire in the wintertime. Remember pleasantly, though I can't recall the sentiments, but remember very pleasantly the remarks sometimes in Sunday morning meeting, first day meeting, by Henry Cadbury. And it seems to me that he was the clerk of the meeting when I was there, and we attended monthly meeting, and I remember his role as clerk and admired it. The presence of Chester Smith and his wife, whose name I should recall and do not.
Gertrude.
Chester and Gertrude was somehow a satisfaction to Marion and to myself. I also, along with many other people, was always glad to see Susan Brooks and her sister,
Esther
Morse. Of course, Susan was long survived Esther, but we remembered the two with real pleasure. We were glad to have the youngsters in first day school. Ironically enough, each one of them eventually became a clerk in their time of the young people's group, as did probably some of yours. But it doesn't seem to have taken.
Well, it's difficult to measure the internal taking.
Some of the values, I'm sure, are there, or were there. But neither one of them continued indefinitely to attend. Linford consciously stepped aside. Fenwick used to attend some after he got back from Germany. And he attended some in Beacon Hill, France. But he has become less interested, and there was a tension over the role in the meeting of persons of his sexual persuasion, and that has left him colder than he might otherwise have been. I think that the group of which he was one, more openly received now than then, was received then, but with reluctance, I suspect that they pushed for a degree of autonomy and recognition which wasn't too friendly. I don't know that, but I'd rather think so. That particular issue seems to have subsided in the meeting, if not entirely in Fenwick. I worked with several committees, forgotten which they were. I was not on the ministry council. I did serve temporarily while someone was absent as acting clerk, and I made careful preparation before the meeting with Elmer Brown so that the meetings ran fairly smoothly, I think, fairly expeditiously. Haste is not a part of it, but on the other hand, you do like to get through. But I was not sure that I would suitably handle the tensions on the war issue and was not ready to become a permanent clerk, although it was suggested that maybe I should. For a while, I don't mean permanent, but full-time clerk for a while. So I didn't do that. Somewhat after that, the school issue bloomed. I remember before that time, before my service as clerk, acting clerk, the school committee had come to the fore. Waring was anxious to have a school, and the wife of a physicist from MIT,
Margaret Bainbridge,
was actively and helpfully interested in that, and so was our present meeting member, sociologist.
Well,
David McClellan. I remember them as active in the, along with Waring, in the undertaking to get a school gathered, place for it to work, meet, and so forth and so on. Marion and I were both extremely skeptical of the proposal, the enterprise. We did not oppose it, but we didn't sympathize with it, and we didn't join in with it. I don't know when I got over the fence, nor exactly what brought me over. Probably it was simply the degree of success which the committee in its fortitude and vision was achieving. I had been chairman of the finance committee for a while. George Selleck, when they came to want to raise some funds, George Selleck asked me if I would take it on for the meeting. And he said he hoped I wouldn't say no this time. And so I did say yes. I made a condition that we be able to retain professional fundraising counsel and administration, otherwise I would not undertake it. There was some reluctance to have that done, but it was not pushed.
It turned out to be a very wise
thing. Yes, it was necessary. Of course, Ethel Amory, who was vital in that, I guess she had been active in the initial operations of the school committee. I don't remember for sure. I rather think that she was. But when push came to crunch, it became known, I have forgotten just how, I think she said in the meeting that she would make a contribution to the school fund of, what, 15,000, maybe 20, I've forgotten, or something like that. And I think that that did a lot to steady a lot of nerves, including my own. She was, of course, much admired and loved by everybody. And her approval obvious and vocal backing was certainly a moving circumstance. Chester Smith, somewhere along, I've forgotten again whether he said it privately or publicly, I think he said it probably in the monthly meeting, that the money was there, and it just took some hooking up of the wires. I made the proposal for the amount of money to be raised and for the retention of counsel, and that prevailed in the meeting, as I recall, without any real hesitancy. The leaders had been at it for a number of years, and the school had been in session, and it seemed to be a successful venture in foreign housing, and the real hope that we might get some more permanent housing, which would be under the control of friends. And so it finally worked along with the final proposal was to raise some funds was not a problem.
Were you involved in the decision to raise some money for the meeting at the same time as part of the same fundraising effort?
Yes, that was part and parcel of the proposal. It was a much smaller amount, of course. This was proposed. I mean, the whole package, if I remember rightly, was suggested to be 200,000, and we shortly raised it to 220. And a portion of that, I've forgotten how much, was for the school and a portion was for the meeting. You may recall the proportions, I don't know. And the fact that McClelland and the rest of the school committee had retained an architect and had a rough idea of the form of and scale of construction and a model for it was quite helpful to us in retaining or acquiring professional counsel. We met several, I've forgotten how many, 3 or 4, and we tried one local man at the suggestion of some friends in the meeting who thought maybe we could ourselves do it under the guidance of some local magnate. I was hesitant on that, but I went through the hoops on it anyway and called on people to see whether they would undertake it. They wouldn't. And that delayed our final hiring of the firm and the man who did come with us and proved to be so congenial and successful. He helped set our sights on what we might be able to raise, began to look for people to be the leaders of the effort, and Ethel Amory was one, and Finley Perry the other, along with George Selleck, of course, and we worked as a group to try and bring people in the meeting into it, and they certainly came without too much resistance. And many of them seemed to have a good time in the solicitation, actually. I do not see that my own spiritual life, whatever that is, was greatly changed in the course of my stay at Cambridge. I seldom spoke in meeting, and I seldom do now, although I have been known to. Marion valued the meeting. Again, I can't put into words what her feelings and reactions were. She valued the meeting as a whole, as well as the persons whom she met there. One of the things which she did on the Sunday school, of course, was to work actively every spring with the May Fair for a number of years, sometimes as its chair, and sometimes more recent years as just one of the people who went along with it. Fenwick went to the fair one time and looked around and bought the biggest book that he could find. And it turned out to be Gray's Anatomy. And I think he still has it. And some MD saw it and said he would be delighted to buy it from him anytime he wanted to sell it. He didn't sell it. But I enjoyed serving for a while on the yearly meetings investment committee. Who is a gentleman from Hartford? who was a leading light in the yearly meeting, and was the chairman of the finance committee for the yearly meeting.
Ralston Thomas?
No. Ralston Thomas was a member of the investment committee.
Bob Brill?
No.
From Hartford?
Hartford.
He gave a lecture this year.
Tom Bodine?
Tom Bodine. Tom Bodine gave a lecture this year at yearly meeting?
Yes.
That's interesting. It was Tom Bodine that I was referring to. He had been chairman of the committee. And came the question whether he would continue for a while or not. And I said, well, somebody had thought that maybe I might do that. And I told him that I was going to be moving to out of the territory in a couple of years, and if I was ever to serve, now would be the time. So instead of extending his stay, he stepped aside, and I was the chair for 2 years, but I didn't get to finish off my second year, really, because I came down with the cancer just before the yearly meeting. So somebody else had to try and pick up the presentation, which I had expected to be making. I've been to a yearly meeting a couple of times since, but not as often as I would like.
Yearly meeting is surely hopping now with young people.
Well, that's good. And so is the meeting, it seems to me. Cambridge.
Yes. Well, if I remember right, you and Caleb and Russell DeBurlo were on a committee studying the functioning of the yearly meeting investment committee. Is that right?
Oh, I guess. I had forgotten that. I didn't remember that at all. I scarcely remember it now. Yeah. I think that's true.
Getting it to put on a unit basis and getting it invested in stocks, or mixture of stocks and bonds instead of solely in bonds.
I don't remember that. I don't remember it as being solely in bonds at any time I was associated with it.
In the 1960s, we were heavily in bonds?
Well, you said solely. Yes, I know we were heavily in bonds. And that was one reason I was reluctant to see them sell the oil company. Atlantic Richfield. I was a sole voiced dissenter to the sale of a block of stock of Atlantic Richfield Oil Company. I had no particular feeling for that oil company, but I did have a feeling for stocks as opposed to bonds and for some natural resource stocks, and I was just reluctant to see that sold, to put the money into bonds, and I said so. Nobody took me up, so I had to recede into the background, and the sale and purchase were made, and very shortly thereafter, the Atlantic Richfield struck it quite warm up in the Beaufort Sea area. Stock skyrocketed. But I don't remember being all in bonds. It would be my vague recollection that that division was promulgated as much by yourself as anyone, maybe more. I thought it was an ingenious arrangement. I remember that it was made. I have no recollection of having participated in the decision that it should be done. I probably did, but I don't remember that.
Well, it's your signature on the memorandum that sets this thing up.
Okay. When was this? When I was acting clerk?
No, I think it's when you were treasurer.
Okay, well, I don't remember it. And it well could be that there was some committee which made the design and the recommendation, and that whoever was treasurer had to sign it and did. But I remember the fact, and I think that I remember your role in it, and that's all I remember. And I, when you tell me that I signed a piece of paper which set it out, you're informing me.
We're mindful of a number of things as I'm slowly going through papers, that things that you apparently don't remember, you actually did bring about. And so I think your contribution to the meeting has been something that goes far beyond your recollection.
Well, that's very nice if I am so viewed by yourself or whoever, but I recall that the division was made. That's it.
Well, before we exhaust all of those recollections, and you were talking about Plan E and the role you and Marion played on Judge Brooks and others getting that established in Medford.
We had no role in getting it established in Medford. None whatever. It was established in Medford by an active group of several men, one of whom was the late Ward, I've forgotten his first name, and some others. They wore out a lot of shoe leather, walking up and down the streets in support of a vote to install a Plan E form of charter to replace the form, mayor, and whatever it was form which they had before. And I think that this was in 1945 or 6, and it got on the ballot, and the town had been in bad shape, and the town went strongly for the change of charter to install a Plan E form. And the group of men who had been the, I shall call it, I don't know what they did call it, the Plan E Charter Committee, said, well, now that we've got it in here, we better try and watch it and try and help it. So the Plan E Charter Committee members sat down one evening and drew up the articles by which they transformed themselves into the Medford Plan E Civic Association. And they endorsed the first candidates to be elected under the new charter. I'm not sure that all of their endorsees prevailed, but that was one of their first roles after they had got the charter on, was to try and get the better people on the council to administer it. The group went out and hired a city manager. And I understand that some member of the city council called the prospective city manager on the telephone, and after the conversation between the two of them, the prospective city manager declined to come to Medford. Shurtleff did agree to come to Medford, that meaning that he was a second choice. We voted in the election for the council members. We did, in our first venture voting, we voted for one of the scamps in the city. And that made us tend favorably toward the association when it was formed. I was fairly engrossed in getting underway with big classes in a new place. And I didn't get out very much, but one day Marion read, we subscribed to local newspaper and used it. Marion saw an advertisement by the Medford Planning Civic Association stating a time and place of their meeting and inviting public participation. So she went down and attended. And they met in the basement of a bank, one of whose members, I think, was a member of the association. And she was favorably impressed with what she saw. She went again, and after she'd been gone 2 or 3 months, why, they asked her to be secretary. And so she started out as secretary of the Medford Planning Civic Association. She used to come back and tell me about the businessmen she met and the women she met, their interest in civic affairs, and a little bit about the problems of the city. And then about 19, I don't know whether she was active in 1951 or not, I think she was. There was an election in 51. And I think that she campaigned for the endorsees of the Civic Association, which endorsed for the City Council and also for the Board of Education. School committee, they called it up there. And I went out, traipsed around with her on some of the campaigning. I hadn't started going to the meetings, but about that time I did. And so I began to go to the meetings of the association, and presently I was added to her as a member of the board of the Planning Civic Association. And along about 1953 or 55, I guess it was 55, our very smart president wasn't quite driving things enough. We had some kind of a public event which we needed to sell tickets for. And I took on with one of the women some of the sales of tickets that wasn't going very well, and two of us tried to see if we could make it go better, and we had some degree of success. And that may have been in 53. I can't remember the years of all these events, really. After a while, campaign seemed to be dragging. I talked with 2 or 3 people, and they thought it was dragging, and I talked to Jim Fallon, who was the president. And so the upshot of it was that I became, not by name, but in effect, a campaign manager. And he wanted to know if he should resign. I said, certainly not. I went home. I had a cold, went home, and took a couple of days out from school, which I probably shouldn't have done, but I did. Sat on a back porch and drew up a budget for the campaign and presented the next meeting. It was the first one they'd ever heard of. And Judge Brooks spoke to the vote for the budget. And then in the course of the campaign, he sent us a check for $100 three separate times. He didn't give us $300, he gave us three $100 checks spread out. Some of our candidates prevailed and some didn't. I think we had a majority, but some of them were compromised. We weren't running all angels. We were running the people who were available and the most promising or the least unpromising, as the case might be. Marion and I used to go home and wonder how long we would have to endorse John C. Carr, Jr. for mayor. Judge Brooks always supported Carr's candidacy while he was still a member. When he became a judge, he stepped aside, but he'd been an attorney, of course. And as an attorney, he was with us in presence, in mind, and in fact, he attended the meetings. He did for a while after he was a judge, but he stepped aside. I've forgotten just when. Campaigned, and it wasn't long before some of us were before his court. So it was good that he could step aside. Our activities got a little stronger. We began to try and have a two or three mailings or three or four mailings, a campaign in support of our candidates. And for, I don't know, two or three campaigns, Marion organized the addressing of 17 or 18,000 addresses for two or three mailings. She got it done by volunteers during the summer. She carried stuff around from one house to another to get it done and went around to pick it up. And she was agreeable and persuasive, and people worked for her. And so she made a rather substantial contribution to the organization of our campaigns. We rejoiced one spring when an MD appeared as a candidate for the board of for the school committee. Pardon me. We thought, well, here we have a professional, a man of competence and presumed independence, and we're delighted to endorse him. And it turned out that he had a brother-in-law in the school system, a fellow who needed a job in the 30s and got it in the school, had not done too much to gather any respect or competence since. We had a school assistant principal on the Hillside School, grades 1 through 6, I think it was, a woman who had been long in harness and was quite effective and a ideal candidate for principal. And this other guy, whose name I've forgotten now, and it took his brother-in-law to nominate him. Nobody else would. But since his brother-in-law nominated him, they were able to get enough votes in the Board of Education to vote him in. I think it was a 7-member board, and I think probably the vote was 4-3, but he became the principal. Professor of English at the at Tufts College, and his wife, the managing editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and several other people joined in a suit. A similar situation arose in another part of the city. There was a woman in the post of assistant principal who was good and was competent and should get the job of principal, and there was a guy in the wings who was cataloged to get the vote. He didn't get it. And we understand that he didn't get it because of the fear of the public point of view, which we had agitated, and the possibility of legal complications. When our appeal was finished, the judge was still against us, but we had made a difference in that one out of two principalships, despite us, went to the wrong guy, and because of us, went to the right woman. John C. Carr got worse and worse. Yes, I was president at the time of these Medford Planning. I was president 2 separate times. Maybe for 2 years once, I'm not sure. 2 separate times, I'm sure of. The city council fired the auditor, one of our planning endorsed candidates having gone over the fence. The man who then, who had been or was to be president, was a minor executive. He was an engineer and a minor executive up at Lynn Plant of General Electric. Called me on the telephone one night. He said, I wonder if it wouldn't be a good idea for a petition to be presented in City Hall against the firing of, asking the reinstatement of the auditor. He said, one of the people over in St. Francis, man, who was with us, and whose bank we had met for a while, had picked out a woman married to a city worker, Irishman, she being Italian, who would present the petition. And I said, yes, that sounds excellent to me. It didn't have name Plan E on it. It wasn't being done by any officer of Plan E. Marie Salvatelli was a member, but she was just a member. The petition was presented. A lot of people signed it. It got nowhere except to keep the ball rolling. They wound up firing a city manager, John Shurtleff. Shurtleff, I forgot what his name. He was a professional, and replacing him with the father of the mayor, John C. Carr, whom Judge Brooks had said should be endorsed, and whom we had endorsed, and whom we had growled about having to endorse, and had hoped we would sometime be able to not endorse him. And so when they fired the city manager and put in the father, another petition. And Emily Flint, who had been a member of the Zana Club in the city of Medford, chairman of the trustees of the library, active in the very small Unitarian Church, which was a handicap, I guess. The other things were advantageous. She sat down one morning and called somebody in each of the 26 wards of the city. Will you accept copies of the petition? Give them out to people who call to have them signed. Take them back when they're signed and keep them for us. And she got a positive response in each of the 26 wards or precincts or whatever it was in the city. That's simply an incredible task, which had to be based on a lot of things. And she really pulled them up and gelled it.
I think you really did have a very creative influence there in the political scene.
No question about it. We helped keep the thing going. It's still going, but doesn't have the same vitality. The next step was that Carr's people called every one of these people who was handling the petition and found out they were for real. There were about 8,000 signatures before they were done, rolled up and presented to the city council. Well, of course, it had no effect on the city council, but it sure had a lot of effect on the public. And the turncoat, the mayor was a turncoat, and he had one of the turncoat with him at this juncture. And the two turncoats were the first one, didn't survive the primary. And only one survived the election. He was John McGlynn. I had once, when I was managing a campaign, had earlier on suggested to, that year, suggested to Fallon, the president, that we ought to go after John McGlynn because of some family connection. Now I've forgotten what it was. And Fallon said, well, he said, let's not. He might be useful someday. So we didn't. We put out a publication which was mailed with, under the addresses which Marion had prepared. It was a 4-page item. So the next thing was that the next campaign, we John McGlynn came down to see if he'd be endorsed. I still have his summons to me to show cause why I shouldn't be tried for criminal libel. And a similar title for similar summons from other members of the city council. Not all, but some of the members of the city council. But the city editor pointed out that he was the only survivor and surmised that he might have learned something. That was right after the election in which we turned him out except for John McGlynn, and in which the mayor and his henchmen had been turned out even before the final election.
Well, the interests of truth are served in many ways.
Yes, they are.
It's very important in a democracy to have attention to the people that we elect and the way they behave after they're elected.
Mm-hmm. We affected the city school board, not sufficiently, but we affected it. And there were people who served on that board who wouldn't have been there without the Planning Civic Association, no question about it. And some of them didn't run again after a while, and they got tired, but they put in a fairly decent superintendent of school with a 5-year contract before they left. And then he's gone, school committee is back to normal political operations.
Rarely
township is almost.
Are there other things that we ought to be thinking about as far as our commission from the oral history?
I see Newland has mentioned some of the friends that meant a lot to him and to Marion in the early days of the meeting.
Henry Perry, of course, is one that I hadn't mentioned. Should.
And at dinner you were mentioning you were born into the Society of Friends in Virginia. I don't think we've got that on this tape.
Father was a member of Goose Creek Meeting. And mother was a member of Greenwich Meeting, or had been. I don't know what her membership was until she became a member of Swarthmore. She did. She was a member of Greenwich. She became a member of Swarthmore, and the intervening steps, if any, I don't know. But father was born in Lincoln. The Goose Creek Meeting is situated in Lincoln.
Virginia?
In Virginia. Loudoun County, Virginia. And I was born in 1904, and I think that father at the time was resident as a renter in West Philadelphia. And he knew he wasn't going to stay there, so that he had not moved his membership. His membership remained at Goose Creek, and I was born in 1904, and so became a, what's the proper phrase, or improper?
What's
the proper phrase for that improper condition? Birthright member. So became a birthright member of the Goose Creek Friends Meeting at Lincoln, Virginia.
Although you were born in Philadelphia.
I was born in Philadelphia. Well, I'm still a renegade. I am still a resident in Medford Leys and a member in Cambridge, and have been since 1972, and will probably remain so.
But you're a member of Cambridge.
That's what I say. I'm resident here. But, member of Cambridge.
But member of Cambridge going back to 1940-something.
I wouldn't give the date. I don't know whether it's 40 or 50. I was there and attending meeting before I was a member.
You and Mary Ann had long, long years of service to the meeting, which has been great.
Well, not as long as yours, but long.
It's very useful to have had this evening together, as well as the other morning.
Well.
Thank you very much.